Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today, for a change of pace, we're going to talk about a book called Bill Warrington's Last Chance. This is a new fiction novel by James King, and he's here to talk about it. And it's being published, I should mention, by Viking, and it's just out in all your bookstores. Hello.
Hello, David. It's great to be here.
That's great to have you on the show. I've been looking forward to this. I have to admit, I started reading this book, and I didn't think I was going to like it at first. And that's happened to me a lot lately. I think it's my mind. Before I knew it, this book just totally enthralled me. It's just all of a sudden I was so curious about these characters. How long did it take you to come up with these characters? I mean, they're all very unusual people. I don't think there's a normal one anywhere in this book.
It's truly a group of dysfunctional people, like a lot of families, actually.
Did you do that on purpose? Create all these dysfunctional people?
Well, I didn't start out by saying, I'm going to write a novel about a dysfunctional family, and everybody in it's going to be dysfunctional. What I wanted to write was a realistic family. Pardon me. And so as I created the characters, I wanted to present them warts and all. Maybe sometimes the warts kind of tick over in some parts of the story, but I wanted to make them, above all else, believable. I didn't want to write so dysfunctional that, you know, you just want to tear your hair out.
So you don't know, do you know people like this?
Don't we all?
I mean, I would never ask you to name names, but are there people in your... Well, maybe I shouldn't even ask you that question. I may get you in trouble. But
I think you're asking if there are people in my family like this. I mean,
well, maybe, but I'm not so sure I should ask that question. I don't want to offend your family.
I come from a large family. There are 9 of us. And none of the characters are based on anybody in my family. And in fact, the title character, Bill Warrington, was actually inspired by a neighbor of mine. And he's really the only one that has any kind of basis in somebody that I know. The others were all...
Now, does he know this book is about him?
No, he died, I guess, about 10 years ago. And it's not really about him. It's just his personality inspired Bill Warrington. Because when my wife and I first moved here into our home here in Wilton, Connecticut... he was a neighbor that came over to introduce himself, but he was a very New England Yankee type of character. And he came stomping into our house in his big work boots and, you know, flannel shirt, and kind of sat down and, you know, asked when we were going to start a family. He didn't use those words, but he was a character. And we later found out that just 2 weeks before that, he had lost his wife of more than 50 years.
So you were kind of a replacement, somebody to talk to.
Well, I think that's what he was looking for, actually. And, you know, as we got to know him, and I would go over there every now and then, and I noticed that the house that he had built with his own hands for his wife was literally falling apart around him. And now, he didn't suffer from dementia the way that... The title character does, and I have no idea.
And that's very frightening. That's a very frightening aspect of this book, the dementia of this guy is.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the figures are. I don't know how many people go through something like this, but it seems like every family has somebody somewhere that goes through something like this.
That's true. And that's one of the things that I've noticed when people talk about the book. They say, oh, this reminded me of my grandmother, or I have an aunt that, you know, suffered from this, or a sister or whatever. And more and more, as the population ages, I guess, I don't know, I did research into the disease of Alzheimer's. I didn't, you know, none of the statistics or anything, but it seems to be one of those very cruel diseases that is touching more and more people.
Yeah, they're always saying that you should do things with your mind, you know, crossword puzzles and all kinds of, you know, the Sudoku puzzles would give you a headache as far as I'm concerned. Those things that drive me nuts. I can only stare at those blocks for so long before my head wants to come off.
I've given up on those. I can't handle them.
But they're just, I don't understand the thrill of over and over again. I get too frustrated not being able to figure them out faster than I should be able to, you know. But to use your mind to keep thinking, and I actually saw a book today where it's telling you 100 things you can do to improve your memory and make sure you don't get Alzheimer's. And it's like, wow, 100 things to do? That's going to take a long time.
More and more prevalent.
But you find yourself, as you're reading this book, and it's a wonderfully written book. I mean, you really capture the essence of these characters so very well.
Thank you.
I mean, you're very good at that. But you really find yourself, and I found myself at times hating, not hating Bill, but not liking him very much. And again, getting frustrated with him.
Well, he's certainly initially, he's not a likable character in many ways. I tried to sprinkle some, empathetic little notes along the way, and I'm glad you stuck with it, by the way.
Right.
But that's one of the challenges with a book like this, is how do you present a character that, for all intents and purposes, doesn't really deserve to be liked, or isn't doing things externally. His behavior isn't something that you would admire or be drawn to.
And he's really blaming his children for a lot of things that may be his fault. That's the sense I get of the book. I mean, there are things that he's mad at them about, and they're mad at him, and, that's the way families are. We get mad at each other. And what are the things we really get mad about? They're really, a lot of times, very trivial things.
That, you just nailed it right there. That's what I was, in many ways trying to get across, was these little misunderstandings can fester when people don't talk to each other, when they make assumptions about the other person's intent and so on and so forth. And then you have the whole family dynamic and sibling rivalry and father-son or father-daughter tension. I mean, it's just a minefield.
It really is.
You think about it. And that really is what I was trying to get at, is often the things that lead to drive families apart.
And why do you think families live across the country? Everybody says, I have a so-and-so in California. They're all over the place. I mean, it's not accidental that they move away.
Right.
This doesn't so happen. You have a family in California and you live in Pennsylvania or wherever. There's reasons the families can't live together.
Right.
Frightening as it might be, it's a fact of life that, I mean, you've got eight brothers and sisters, you said?
Right, yes.
You sound like you could get along with them, though.
I do. In fact, I don't know what this says, but I'm one of two that does not still live in Ohio. They all still live in Ohio. I moved away from Ohio right after, high school, really. I mean, I went to college, but after that, then I took off. And not so much to get away from my family, but just to see the world a little bit. And it so happened that I ended up in Connecticut. And luckily, one of my older brothers, whose career was in the Air Force, his last assignment was to head up the ROTC program at the University of Connecticut. So out of all the states in the Union, the two of us end up in Connecticut. Kind of weird.
That's wonderful. And how far is he from you, from where you live?
Maybe an hour and 15 minutes, something like that. Not bad at all.
Where did you write this book? I mean, what state were you in when you wrote the book? Now, I know you said you told me before that it won some kind of a prize on the Internet?
It won the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award.
And do they do that every year?
This is the year that I won it was the second year. They've done it for 3 years now.
What are their criteria for a book that wins?
To enter, the criteria is the finished manuscript, obviously.
Right.
And the award is publication by Penguin, one of the co-sponsors. So the way the contest works is you submit your manuscript, and the year that I entered, there were about 6,500 entries in 22 different countries.
And you were the one that won out of all 6,500.
Talk about the lotto.
That's amazing.
The jackpot. Yeah.
That's really, no, then the reason you won is because you have talent. This is a very, very, this is a very well-written book. It reminds me, in some ways, of Pat Conroy.
Oh, wow. Great.
J. just in the family dynamics and the family dysfunctional stuff. He loves to write dysfunctional characters in his books. In fact, I don't think there's any functional ones in his characters. What is a functional character anyway?
Well, who wants to read about them?
Yeah, so they're too boring. You know, then you'd have, you know, I won't name any author names, but they're, you know, there's always those books that you read, you know where the story's going half the time, and it's part of a series, and it's just the same thing over and over and over and over again. And maybe the characters change a little bit, but the characters change a lot in this book, in your book. And you know, they let off steam. They have a lot of, there's a lot of anger, and there's a lot of resentment flying around like crazy.
Right, and that's the stuff that we live with every day. Perhaps not to that degree, depending on what our relationships with families are. I mean, I never experienced that growing up, and thank goodness I have a wonderful relationship with my own children. So, but it's interesting stuff. And again, it gets back to what you pointed out earlier. It's just these little misunderstandings that can go so far awry.
Yeah, and it's usually something silly, you know, something that well, I mean, maybe it wasn't silly at the time, but it in your mind, it blows into this huge thing, like, oh, well, they did that to me 30 years ago. It's like, well, get over it, will you?
Right.
I mean, it's your father and sister, for goodness sake. And it's very easy to hold a grudge. I mean, let's face it. I mean, sometimes it's even fun.
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it hurts us in the long run. I mean, it's stressful.
It's hard to let go. And so I used to joke with my brothers when we'd get together and say, geez, the minute we all walk in the door, we're back in high school, you know, and we're all in our 40s and 50s. But that's just part of that fabric of family, I guess.
And that's part of the book. I remember that line from your book, too, about being back in high school.
Oh, yes. That's right. There was a scene between Nick and Marcy where he begged her, please, can we, you know, get past high school? But, I talk to one of my sisters frequently, and we're still laughing at the same stupid jokes.
So what does your family think of your book? What have they said to you about it? I assume they've all read it.
Yeah, I think so.
You think you're not sure?
some of them withheld judgment, and that to me, or have withheld their comments, and that tells me maybe I better not ask them. But on a serious note, the response has been very positive, and they've been very, very supportive.
Did you know you could write? I mean, is it something that you've been festering for a while, or did it just come? Did you just try it because you wanted to, or how did it come about?
Well, this is actually the fourth full novel that I've written.
So where are the other three? Begs the question.
They're in my desk drawer here.
Oh, really?
They've collected hundreds of rejections from agents and publishers. This is the first one. I've been trying to get a novel published since I was in my 20s. I'm in my 50s now. So this.
This is major excitement for you.
It's a lifelong dream come true.
So what? I assume you've seen your book in the bookstore.
Oh yes.
So tell me what your reaction was when you first saw it.
Well, it was. It's really hard to describe. The first time I saw it, I was with my editor. She brought along a copy, I think, the day before the bookstores got it. We were doing a presentation together, and she brought it. And just holding that book in my hand and thinking about how long I wanted to be able to do that. I don't know about you, but when I pick up a book, I look at the cover, I turn it over, see what's on the back, I open it up.
Which you can't do with a Kindle.
No, you can't. You can't. And I even smell it, you know.
Right. And see, that's all stuff that you can't. I mean, and I hate to say that about Kindle, but you know, I grew up holding books. When you have a book in your hand, there's something about that can never be matched with any kind of an e-book.
No, it's and I have a Kindle, and you know, for my work, and you asked, I'm a freelance writer, so I've been, you know, fortunate, and I've been able to pay the bills by doing some nonfiction writing, but this is my first, you know, fiction book that's been published.
That's really terrific. I mean, I couldn't be happier for you.
Oh, how nice. Thank you.
I mean, I really mean that. And we all know how tough it is to get a book published. You know, don't we all have thoughts? I often think to myself, I'm going to come up with a great novel. It's going to be like Twilight. It's not going to be like Twilight, but it's going to be a great idea like Twilight. And I'm going to publish it and make a fortune off it.
That's kind of how I felt about each of the three books that I wrote previous to this. It's like, okay, now I got an idea. Yeah, this is going to be the one. I know this is going to sell. It's a good idea. I just have to pull it off. And then I start sending it out and collecting rejections. With this fourth one that finally did get published, I have to say there was, my wife has read all the other ones as well and was very supportive and everything, but as she was reading this one, she looked up one night as she was reading the manuscript and she said, "This is the one." So I don't know what the difference is.
You're getting me all teary-eyed now. I don't know why. That's such a nice thing to say. And to have somebody say that to you, especially somebody you love as much as you love your wife,
right.
That's got to mean a lot to you. And it doesn't do her any good to not tell you the truth, you know? If she didn't like it, she'd have to tell you she didn't like it.
She's quite unsparing, some of the previous novels. And this one, too. You know, if she read a scene that she didn't like or, you know, it was going in a direction she didn't think was good for the story, she'd not shy about telling me.
So I have to ask you, at one point you mentioned a crossword clue of dog treats.
Yes.
Five letters, and you never tell what the answer was.
No, of course not.
And I'm still wondering what it is.
I have no clue.
Oh, you don't know?
I picked up a crossword puzzle somewhere and just stole a couple of clues.
Really? So there really is no answer?
Never tried to solve it. It's out there somewhere. Maybe we have to contact, Will Short.
I got the feeling that you somehow knew and were going to tell us later on. It was somehow going to come into the story somehow.
No, nothing hidden there. That's just...
Because usually when that happens, usually they tell you the answer at some point or another.
Well, you've pointed out a flaw there.
No, it's not a flaw. It's just...
No, I know. I'm kidding. But actually, now that you brought that up, that's kind of an interesting perspective because, if you had, maybe later on in the story, it could have been tied back to something. But
it didn't take away from the story at all. In fact, it made me more eager to read the rest of it so I could find out where the answer to the question was. But it's fine. But what I'm wondering is, I didn't ask you this, but Amazon went into this contest with Penguin, but did Penguin still had to read the manuscript to make sure they wanted to publish it there, didn't they? How does that work?
Yeah, they did. They basically what happens is there's a panel of readers who narrow it down, from, I think I said 6,500, they narrow it down to 1,000 and then 500, then down to 100, and then down to the top three. And then the top three is assigned to an editor. And they read it, and they decide whether or not, which house it should go to. I'm not really sure about that. All I know is that my manuscript ended up on the desk of Liz Van Hoos at Viking, an editor there. And she loved it, and she wanted Viking to publish it. Now, they don't decide who wins the contest.
Yeah, I often wonder how they decide which branch of the company they're going to have it published by. What determines that, I wonder?
I think a combination of luck. In this case, I lucked out because it landed on Liz's desk, and she really liked it. But she wanted Viking to publish it as opposed to one of the other imprints. But the way that the contest winner was decided was on the basis of Amazon reader votes, actually. So they publish on the Amazon site an extended excerpt from the book, and the readers vote for their favorite. And that's how they determine the winner.
Now I want you to explain to the audience exactly what the book's about. We really haven't told much. We've just been skirting the surface of it. But just in a nutshell, tell people what it's about.
Well, Bill Warrington's Last Chance is about an elderly gentleman, ex-Marine, who receives a bad diagnosis, and we know it has something to do with his mind, that basically he's going to be sinking into dementia, and he wants to reunite with his three adult children, but he's been estranged from them for many years for reasons that are gradually revealed throughout the story. he's unsuccessful in reuniting them up front because he's too proud to say exactly why he wants to reunite with them. So he comes up with this scheme to skip town, kidnap, if you will, his granddaughter. So, and she's very eager to be kidnapped because she wants to learn how to drive and also get as far away from her mother, Marcy, as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it never seems like it's a kidnapping.
Yeah, they just, well, they, Bill kind of sets it up as a kidnapping because he leaves clues for the children, for the adult children to talk about. They're not only estranged from him, but they're estranged from each other.
I suppose you could call them adult children. I'm not quite sure they are adults.
Yeah, many times they're not. That's true. So they, so that's how the story is set up, that that Bill and April are on the road in the car. And you're right, it's not so much a kidnapping as kind of a mutual agreement to, you know, I'll teach you how to drive. And, you know, we just need to send these clues. April has no idea what's really going on. All she's excited about is learning how to drive. So as they hit the road, though, the plan unravels because the deterioration of Bill's mind is much faster than anyone anticipated. And so they're on the road, and Bill is losing his mind, and so now it's all about whether or not the family will somehow join forces and reunite to save April.
Right. I'm looking forward to when they do the movie of this to see who plays Marcy. Because Marcy is a spitfire. I mean, I don't know how to describe her other than to say she's a wacko.
But, yeah.
I mean, in some ways. I mean, she's not... I don't know. She's kind of like, yeah, you're angry with her. Yeah, you get really angry with her. But, you know, she's typical in some ways of I don't know what of somebody like her in a family. I don't know exactly what I mean, but I can't really. But
well, there are people that one of the things I like about Marcy is, and this kind of gets back to what we're talking about.
And she had to be fun to write.
She was. And the reason it was fun is because I always knew that beneath the behavior that we talked about earlier, this difference between the behavior and what's going on beneath the surface, you know, I always knew that, you know, this is a woman struggling to do the right thing for her, you know, on her own. She's divorced, trying to, you know, make a go of a new career and raising a 15-year-old teenage daughter. In other words, raising a pain in the butt. And
but she's also pushing her away. I mean, and you wonder, what, don't you know what you're doing to your child? Don't you care?
Yeah, I think every parent can relate to that, though, don't you?
Yes,
I think every, you
absolutely.
Know, we all, it's kind of like when we make that vow never to say the things that our parents said to us, and yet we find ourselves saying those very things.
And the thought of running away from home, of having your child run away from home, is even more terrifying today because there's so many awful people out there.
Exactly.
So it used to be when I was a kid, if I had wanted to run away from home, my mom would have said, good, we'll see you tomorrow. You know, it wouldn't have been a big deal. She knew I'd come back.
Oh, yeah. Well, my mom's response was, do you need bus fare? She knew I'd never make it past the front yard. You're right.
But I love the scene with Marcy where she finally says to Bill, you know, you can have her.
Yeah.
Basically, you can have her.
Yeah, good luck.
Take her.
Right.
Yeah. It's very...
See how you do.
It kind of shocked me. It's a very shocking scene in a way. But not... When you think back on it, you think, well, it really isn't that surprising when you think about what came before.
Yeah. And that's what makes Marcy, Marcy. She feels all of these things inside. But like her father, she's not very good at expressing it. And
unless you make her mad, then she'll express anything she wants.
Oh yeah, then you'll hear from her.
You hit that little nerve, and you don't know what's going to come out. What kind
and
of
she immediately
venom.
Regrets it. She knows, you know, this isn't the way to do it.
I don't think she does regret it. I don't sense that at all.
Hmm.
Does she regret it? You obviously feel like she does.
Well, I think so. I think that, you know, in some of her more reflective moments, when, for example, she's cleaning her room, cleaning April's room, she comes across some of her things. And, you know, she's reminded of the things that really irritate her about April, but, you know, deep down.
It's very deep down.
I guess it's buried.
I mean, it's really buried. I mean, and that's another unusual thing about this book. You don't sense necessarily that she really loves her daughter that much.
Hmm.
I don't sense that. I maybe underneath it all, like you said, but I don't sense that love between them. And she certainly does not like her mother very much. But that's because her mother's holding her back.
Right.
From doing what she feels. Gee, and how many teenagers these days think they know what's best for them, you know? It's like millions and millions of teenagers are going through the same thing.
Well, I think that, again, it's how people express their love for each other. I think that is the difference here. And I think April loves her mother, but she's at an age where that's not easy. And she doesn't realize it until much later in the book. And same with Marcy. She probably is never going to really figure out exactly, you know, what the best way to do some of the things that she does to keep her daughter close are. But she tries.
You're not a psychologist, are you?
No.
You're very good with the psychological aspects of it. I mean, how did you get so good at writing that? I mean, obviously, you got a talent for that, of really getting
characters. You know, they live with you.
Let me tell you, I've read a lot of books, and it is not easy to write. I don't every day read a book that where you feel like you really are getting inside the mind of these characters, and you're really getting down to what's really bothering them. I mean, the two boys, Mike and who's the other guy?
Nick,
thank you. I couldn't think of his name. Mike and Nick are very unusual people, especially Mike. Mike is seems to be very withdrawn.
Yes, very much so.
But a lot of it is in these characters. It is a loss somewhere, whether it be a wife or whatever. There seems to be a loss that triggers something in a lot of these characters.
That's very true, and I think that's what they're really striving for, is to fill that loss with something. Mike with philandering, Nick trying to replace his wife, you know, Marcy looking for a way to raise her daughter and yet feel good about herself.
I mean, what loss does to people is just amazing. I mean, how it can affect some and not others. I mean, some, you know, hold it all in, and that's extremely destructive. That's as bad as letting it all out sometimes.
Yeah, that's very true. Very true.
I mean, we hold it in. We figure, well, we're a man. We should be able to take it. We shouldn't blow up. We shouldn't do this, or you know. And it's as a man, where do we learn that from?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, who teaches us to keep quiet about our emotions? And I mean, what man ever comes home from work and tells their wife, "Yeah, I'm just not feeling myself like myself today. I'm really down the dumps."
And how many wives want to hear that?
Yeah. I mean, have you ever said that to your wife?
I think my wife and I communicated on a pretty, pretty deep level. I think that she senses when I'm down, and then she'll drag it out of me. But I probably am more open with how I feel than maybe a lot of guys.
I think there's a point to that. If you knew that you could feel better if you just express it sometimes, you would probably. Men would probably be more open like that.
Yeah, it's just getting past that initial discomfort about, you know.
I mean, who wants to admit they're not feeling like themselves, or they're depressed, or their life's not going the way they want it to go, or this and or that, or any one of 100 different things are going wrong, or they're too stressed. You know, sometimes you just have to say, "Look, this is too stressful for me. I have to just."
Well, for guys, that's hard. I don't. You know, looking at them
without going to the bar, that is. You
know?
I mean, the local bar is always the answer for guys. You know,
it's true.
I mean, how many, you know, I have my people I work with, and that's their answer, you know. We'll go get a drink. That'll make us feel better.
Right.
And if taking a drink is fine, I'm not advocating drinking excessively.
Of
but
course.
Certainly a glass of wine now and then is nothing to be ashamed of. But,
right.
But it's just amazing what people do to get past that stress.
Well, there's no way you can sit down with Bill Warrington and, you know, say, "Tell me about your feelings." You know, he just represents a whole different, that previous generation where, you know, it just didn't come into play. What was the relevance as far as they were concerned? I'm a baby boomer, and our generation was raised a little bit differently, you know, or educated a little bit differently, where, you know, we started talking, or at least being aware of things going on, and encouraged sometimes to talk about it. But
And if you're a parent now, if you're a parent nowadays, and you have a teenager, you know, how do you get them to open up? How do you get them to talk about things? You know, it's so difficult. I mean, you hear about these kids that committed suicide, and you know it's because they didn't talk about what they were, what was going through their minds. And you know, with this busy society we live in, that, I mean, that's a deadly situation.
It's frightening, very frightening, and that's I think that's why Marcy was so terrified at the thought of losing her. Daughter.
I remember my dad used to say, you know, my mom would get these migraine headaches, and he'd say, just get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you could snap your fingers and you wouldn't have it anymore. I mean, if they were that easy, good grief.
But, and I wonder if that comes from a sense of helplessness, you know, that your dad wanted to help, but, you know, didn't know exactly how.
It could very well be part of it. I think he didn't, but it also comes from a lack of understanding of other people too. And you have to, in my mind, to truly enjoy people around you, you have to be sympathetic toward them to a certain extent. I'm not saying you spend your whole day just being totally sympathetic to everybody. That can drain you very easily.
Right.
But you have to put yourself in that person's shoes and say, well, what caused that? There's a reason they're like that. There's a reason they're like, and if you can understand that and try to be more understanding, I think you find yourself not being so hard on people too.
Well, what you described really is what I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Daniel Goleman and emotional intelligence.
Yes,
That's really what that's all about, and I think that's such a tremendously powerful concept. Is if you are able to not only understand yourself, but if you're able to put yourself in the other person's shoes and understand their motivations and why they might be doing something, at least get out of your own head, that goes a long way toward understanding.
So how the three books that you have in your drawer right now, how are they different from Bill Warrington? I mean, are they as well written in your mind?
No, they're not.
Was it the contest that really drew all this out of you and
no,
made you...
I didn't know about the contest until I finished the book, so that really didn't...
Oh, really? So the contest had nothing to do with writing the book? That's interesting.
No. In fact, I had tried dozens of agents with this book trying to sell it.
Well, what would they say was wrong with it? Why didn't they like it? I mean, just generally, what would they say? Do you remember any of the rejections?
Well, some of them would, some of the things we talked about earlier, as far as, you know, I just couldn't really get with a certain character, for example. You know, well written, but...
like I said, every character in this book is very well drawn out. I really like the way you... I feel like I know them all, and I find myself, getting angry with these people. Even Bill. I mean, Bill, he can't remember his granddaughter's name.
Right.
I mean...
Well, now, if you were an agent, and I had written to you, I might have lucked out, but...
That's right, exactly. But this book resonates with you. You think about it after you're done. You really think about, what would it be like to be a member of this family?
Mm-hmm.
What would it be like to be Bill?
Right. Right.
What must go through his mind? And why the heck is he letting a 15-year-old girl drive a car?
Yeah, there's a lot going on there.
Among other things. But there's so many dynamics in this book. There's so many things you think about. There's so many what-ifs. There's so many, there's frightening things in this book, too. Things that you don't really think about too much. I mean, we don't want to dwell on Alzheimer's too much or anything like it.
True.
And my dad had it before he died.
Oh,
yeah,
he's been awful.
It was, but thankfully he didn't last very long with it.
Mm-hmm.
He was gone because he also had cancer, and that was was horrible. But you know, he would get extremely paranoid, and it was the interesting thing is later at night he would turn on you. It was very odd. It was like when the sun went down, his moods would get darker and darker.
That's the frightening thing about this disease is that it just you. There's a totally different person coming through.
Right, and you look at in the Asian countries where they totally respect older people. And in the United States, it seems like, you know, you're too old. You know, the old people don't have an advantage in the United States. We look at them as, you know, they can't do as much as the younger people. They can't play sports. They can't be entertainers. I mean, look at Betty White. She's an anomaly. I'm 88 years old, and she's got a second career now. But she's the exception rather than the rule. I mean, totally the exception. But, I mean, she's almost brought senior citizenhood back into style again.
Well, I hope it takes hold, because I'm in my 50s now, so.
Does it? Now, how long ago did you write these other three books?
I wrote the first one, I was in my 20s, fresh out of college, actually, a year or so after I graduated from college. Then the second and third, you know, in my 30s and 40s.
So will we ever see them published, you think?
I don't think so, David. I think they were rejected for a good reason.
Do you want them to be published?
No. A lot of people have asked me if I would, you know, pull them out of the drawer, take a look at them, see if I can change something here or there. But I really want to consider those warm-up novels, and I'm perfectly happy to start fresh with a new one, which I have.
So in your mind now, what made Bill Warrington, this book, different? What made it publishable more so than the other ones?
Well, good question, because I believed strongly in the other ones.
But you believe strongly in Bill Warrington's?
I think what's different about this one is perhaps the depth of character, getting into the characters and drawing a dramatic family scenario. Whereas maybe with some of the other ones, I didn't delve as deeply into thoughts and feelings. I don't know. I think in some of the other books there was, you know, as much if not more action, but perhaps there was action at the expense of character development.
So perhaps you're getting better the more you write.
Well, I hope so.
I mean, is that your feeling?
Yes, definitely, and that's why I consider the three previous novels warm-ups.
I mean, you've made it into People Magazine's reviews already, the first book. I mean, that's amazing.
It's nice, yes. That was a thrill.
In fact, that's where I first saw your book, and I thought, this book sounds wonderful. It just, when I read the premise, I thought, this is the kind of book I want to read. This is the kind of book I want to interview the author for, because it just sounded so great.
And yet you almost gave up on it.
I thought I wasn't going to like it at first. I thought it was just, and you know what, I'm such a picky reader that I never know what I'm going to like.
Right.
I'll start a book and I'll think, this has got to get better or I'm going to get bored.
So how many pages do you give a book?
I give a book a lot of leeway. I'll give it as much as 100 pages sometimes.
Oh, you're generous. Yeah,
yeah, very generous. Right. But it depends on the book. It depends
right.
on how bad the book really is. I mean, that's a big part of... But I somehow knew this was going to be get more interesting at first.
You're good. Well,
after reading the first part of it, I thought, well, you know, and it grows on you. It just completely grows on you. Before you know it, you're like, oh, this is really cool. I can't wait to see what's going to happen next, and who's going to react to who, what, where. You know, how this is going to all play out, and how the characters are. Is there going to be any resolution to it?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not easy to resolve these kind of problems.
Well, that's for sure.
I mean, because you really have to sit down and talk to one another. I remember after my dad died, we all had this family meeting, and you know, it's so odd.
Yeah.
It's even odder because you got people that aren't really part of the family. They're married to people in your family, but you feel like they're intruding on you. It's a very strange dynamic. It's very... I don't have to describe it other than to say it's just are very odd, and you feel like, you know, when you're grieving. I remember when my mom died, how much I grieved, and I thought, I can't make any decisions right now. And yet my sisters could just make decisions like that, like, you know, she's dead, let's move on, let's do this, and I couldn't do that. I wanted to grieve. I wanted to spend more time grieving, and as much as I know it has to be done, it's very hard when you're grieving, when you miss somebody. You don't think about anything else.
Yeah, and that kind of what you've described there is what I had hoped to get across in the book, that, you know, even though they're siblings, they all, and you pointed this out earlier, they all deal with things a little bit differently.
And also, I mean, when you think about it, Bill, they're really grieving for the way Bill was.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And he's not that way anymore. He's a different person. And it's very, let's face it, it's a very hard thing to deal with. I mean, look at how much trouble April has in the book.
Right.
It's a very difficult situation because you don't know, and when they start forgetting things, and it scares you. It really does.
Very much, yes.
I mean, we always think of our parents as being there all the time, and nothing's ever going to happen to our parents.
Right.
And, you know, life is very delicate that way, and that's why you have to take every day and enjoy it, because you might not have tomorrow.
Amen.
It sounds really trite, but it's absolutely the truth. But
so true.
Do you plan on writing more books like this? In other words, books that are family oriented, that are where you delve into characters like this. I mean, is this going to be an ongoing thing with you?
I hope so. And the book that I've started now is a family centered drama, very heavy on the character development. And those are the books that interest me. I enjoy the character driven stories more than other genre type of books.
And I look at some of and for some reason I'm thinking of Jodi Picoult, because your book also reminds me of hers, because of the character, the way she draws out these characters is just amazing.
Uh-huh.
The only problem I have with some of her books is she usually has a disease of the book. Every book has a different disease in it.
Uh-huh.
That's central to the plot of the book. So,
well, it seems to be working.
Oh, it's definitely working for her. But after a while, you think, well, can't we have a book where nobody has a disease and it's just family-related problems?
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'll always read her, because I love the way she brings a whole set of characters to life and does it so wonderfully and does it effortlessly. It just seems so effortlessly sometimes.
Yeah, that's the type of story that I really enjoy reading, and that's what I hope to continue writing.
And also, at the end, she always has something unexpected happens at the end, and I just love that. I think that's crucial to a book, to not always know what's going to happen next, and who's going to survive, who's going to totally break down, and who's going to end up where, you know? Well, was there any part of this book that was hard to write? Specifically,
well,
or
all of it?
All of it.
Let's see. Well, I struggled a lot with the beginning and the end. The end, I never knew exactly how it was going to end until I had written everything that came before it. You know, some writers outline everything, and I've tried that, but it works to a certain extent. But
it'll be interesting to see if anybody writes to you and says, "This is exactly my family. How did you know?"
You know, actually, David, I have had that response.
Really?
It's made it all worthwhile, because I've gotten some emails from people saying, you know, I didn't see you in my house. One guy wrote and said, how did you know my brothers? So it's really gratifying to see those kinds of...
Do you think it helps them in some way?
I'd like to think so. I don't know.
Maybe you're their therapist, you know. Let's read his book, and it'll help us to see this is the way we are. We're looking in the mirror here.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Just, you know, I really just hope it touches them and makes them perhaps realize that, you know, if there is a problem, if there is something that needs to be talked out, maybe that's the solution, is talking it out.
Did you know that eventually you would get published? I mean, did you really feel that it would happen eventually?
I always hoped. I never really. I guess, you know, deep down I said, I don't know. I always wanted it. I never wanted to give up on it. I wasn't 100% sure that it was ever going to happen, but I really felt that if I was going to be happy when I turn 75 or 80 and I'm sitting in my rocking chair thinking back over my life, if I had looked back and said, I should have tried harder, then it would have been a huge disappointment.
Have all the reviews been pretty well? I mean, as good as people's?
So far, so good. I've gotten some nice reviews from Booklist. AARP selected it as a quote-unquote hot pick.
Wow, very cool.
Yeah, and I've gotten some nice reviews.
I wonder what the Alzheimer's Society would say about it.
I don't know.
I have to look up online and see what they say. I mean, I'm curious how they would react to it. I mean, everybody's so into, well, is it totally realistic? Is it really? I mean, it seems like it is. Do I know? Did my father go through something like that? Similar, yeah, but not quite as forgetful of names like that. My father always had trouble with names.
Yeah.
He'd always say to my mom, well, what's their name? You know, he'd always, but that was so much a part of my life that it didn't even bother me.
Yeah. Well, I you know, those emails that I mentioned, I've gotten some from people whose family members had Alzheimer's, and they've said, yeah, a lot of the things that are in here, they all assume that that one of my parents had Alzheimer's or someone in my family did, but it's not true. Nobody in my family did.
And you also got two blurbs from Sue Monkid and Sue Grafton. How in the world did you manage that?
Isn't that wonderful? And both really terrific women. Oh, man, so nice and so generous. They actually were expert reviewers for that Amazon contest that I had mentioned.
Oh, really? How interesting.
So when they read the final three books, and those blurbs were taken from their comments.
Really? So did you actually get an email from these two authors, or was it all through?
Oh, I had the great pleasure of meeting Sue Monkid at one of her readings. I went up and introduced myself. She was so gracious, so nice. She remembered the name of my book. And, you know, so I'm a fan for life. She's just wonderful. And Sue Grafton, I believe, lives in California. I've exchanged letters with her. She's been very, very generous.
Have you seen her writing, though? She's got the most wonderful handwriting I've ever seen. I mean, I don't know if she still writes her letters.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the letter was handwritten, which now that you've... I didn't think of that until you just mentioned it.
It's beautiful writing. It's absolutely beautiful writing. I usually get a Christmas card from her every year.
Oh, nice.
Because I'm on her mailing list. She used to send little gifts, which was really cool. Every year you get this little tiny gift. Sometimes it'd be like a paper clip or something similar to that, something a little more useful than that. But it was just cool because it's something to look forward to every book.
Okay.
Obviously, I guess it's become overwhelming because she doesn't, if you go on her website, it says, you know, she's overwhelmed with things. So I think it got a little away from her, the series being as wildly popular as it is. Well, this has been really great to talk to you, and the book, again, is called Bill Warrington's Last Chance. It's by James King. It's from Viking, and it's in all your bookstores now, and ebooks, and on Kindle, and everything, all over the place. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
David, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.